Well, no, I don't know. I don't know whether we should approach this subject head on or not, because when you're touching the dream world, you're touching something far more important, believe me, than the world that's out there, you know, that's raining and that's hitting you on the head and that has a tendency to drift up on you and where the bills come from and all that. As a matter of fact, I think most ladies would defend Tony Perkins far more virulently than they would their husband. Oh, yes. I can say rotten things about any lady's husband on the air here and get no complaining calls. In fact, I get a lot of congratulatory wires. All I've got to do is say one rotten thing about Tab Hunter, and the entire island of Staten moves 20 feet to the left and heaves loudly into the ocean. No, it's true. And this is all part of the dream world that so many of us live in. Now, last night, for those of you who stick with this peregrination here every night, this fistfight we have, you remember last night we touched vaguely on the dream world of the beer commercials and the cigarette commercials. Well, now, there are other dream worlds and other types of commercials, and there is a growing field of sociological study, you know, that is devoting itself to analyzing the things that really operate on a society, not necessarily the things which are self-consciously operating. For example, editorials in the New York Times. I don't think many of you have ever been really moved by an editorial in the Times, or by an editorial in the Mirror or the Post or Confidential, for that matter, or you name it, you know, because these are self-conscious. The things that really move you are the things that come quietly in the night and that go bump. These are the things that you oscillate to and you vibrate to and you go out and you plunk down for. You either buy for, or in some sense you do an actual, a detailed, evolved action related to a specific stimulus. In short, you get up off your thing and go, literally. Now, there are a lot of reasons why you do this, you see, and most of these reasons are unspoken. And in fact, we don't even know most of the cases why, if they exist, or why they exist, or will we admit that they do? Because the minute you do, you're in trouble. The minute you're aware of the existence of these things, it is difficult then to be motivated by them. So it's a kind of self-defeating thing. Now, there are other kinds of ads, and for example, now since we're dealing in the advertising world for these two nights, if you're not interested in, you go back down to the other station where there's a guy going to read Fu Manchu for you, so you're all right. You know, there's always some place you can go to get the escape, so you go on down and get it. But one of the greatest examples of the unconscious truth. Now, here, first of all, I have to lay out a premise. That sociologists and psychologists are interested in our selections for tools. What we select for tools. These little selections make a great deal of sense to a sociologist. In short, if you have 10,000 things to choose from, say, to put in your ad, you have a million things to choose from. You can have a field of flowers, you can have a cloud, you can have a picture of the ocean. Why do you pick a specific thing to make your point? Well, there are reasons that go beyond the specific reasons that are stated when the selection is made. Now, here's a wonderful example of it. There was a full-page ad in the New York Times the other day. Now, the Times is a very official newspaper. And let me tell you this. When one newspaper is advertising in another newspaper, that's double officialdom. That's like a double stamp of approval by both gigantic mammoths, behemoths. And especially when you have the kind of newspapers involved, you know for a fact that there's nothing more official than the Times. There are other papers that are more accurate. There are other papers that are more in-depth. There are other papers that are more detailed. There are other papers that are probably even more objective, believe it or not. Even though this might come as a shocking thing to many readers of the Times, there are such papers. Nevertheless, there is no paper that bears the fantastic imprint of the Times. All over the world, the New York Times is like the official organ of the world. Now, everybody, oh yeah, that's true. Believe me, they read it every day, every last line in Pravda. They do. I can assure you. They read every last line in the editorial rooms of the Hessville Gazette. This is very true, too. Hessville, well, that's a later program. Now, the other day, there was a full-page ad in the Times that was taken up by the Wall Street Journal. Now, there you have two twins of officialdom. One represents objectivity in the affairs of men. The other represents objectivity in the dough world. And as you know, there's something almost ecclesiastical about money in America. It's, in some cases, even a religion. It is interchangeable in many areas. It isn't so much the money changers have entered the temple. The money changers own the temple in many places, and they don't enter it at all. They just go out and play golf, and all the parishioners go to the temple that they own. But that's another story. Now here you have a full-page ad, see? And the ad is for the Wall Street Journal. And there you see a beautiful action picture of Maury Wills. Oh, yes, it's a full-page, half-page picture of Maury Wills. He's sliding, and you see the dust flying, and he's looking taut, and he's angry, you know, and he's just bristly, and he's just making it in there. You can just see him sliding into second base, and he's getting ready to spring up, you know, to see whether or not the ball has rolled away from the infielder so he can make the try for third. He's really in action. And underneath it is the caption, and I will roughly paraphrase here, Maury Wills did it. Why can't the American businessman? And then they go on to say that what they're abjuring the American businessman to do is to become successful. It says Maury Wills took a moderately successful season, the 250 season, 295 season, he hit something like that, and he turned it into a gigantic season by stealing. Now, they didn't say that. They didn't come right out and lay it on the line. Now, the question is, of all the millions of choices for a possible illustration of success, why Maury Wills? Are you aware of what Maury Wills was famous for, oh, baseball haters? Well, Maury Wills was famous for stealing. Now, that's right. He was famous for stealing, literally stealing. He stole over 100 bases. Now the psychologists and the sociologists would be fascinated by the choice of Maury Wills to hold up as a moral example to the American businessman, you see, because the American businessman is not quite in the same business that Maury Wills is in. That would be roughly like hanging Al Capone's picture in the Sunday school. It says, Al rose from humble beginnings to become the top gun in Chicago, kid. Now, I'm not putting down Maury Wills. I'm merely saying that Maury Wills was famous for something that is usually never admitted is done in the business world. So what is the first thing that comes to your mind when you see a picture of Maury Wills? Just automatically. Success? I doubt it. Steal. That's the only thing you associate with Maury Wills. Now, they could have picked, say, Al Kaline, who had a higher batting average. In fact, Al Kaline is a better ball player in almost every department than Maury Wills. Are you aware of that? Oh, yes. But they didn't pick Al Kaline, you see. they picked a guy who was famous for stealing. Now I'm not putting that specific ad down, but these things are all part of the secret dream admissions. Yeah, that's right. The secret dream admissions that we make in our ads without knowing we make them. Now take for example, again, let's get back onto some other closer to home examples. Here is a little example. Now, for one thing, it is difficult for us to say a lot of things that are inside of us. We live by a certain set of rules, and we act on a certain set of other rules. Those are the ones we won't admit to. The other ones we have embroidered in pillows. The other ones we have made in little blue and white signs that we hang in offices, like think. As a matter of fact, very few people ever really think in their lives, you know. They react. It's a very different thing. I'd like to see a blue and white sign that merely says, react. That's all. This is just the way people. Now, of course, what happens is generally after a man has reacted, let's say the assistant head of advertising comes in and says something to the chief. The chief doesn't like it. He belts him in the mouth. Well, now, the chief is not thinking. He's reacting. But 30 seconds later, he has evolved a very, very complete rationale. Yes, it has to have an exclamation point. A very complete rationale as to why he belted the guy in the mouth. Now, which came first? Of course, the reaction came first much quicker than the thought. Many a man, when he is motivated to buy a new car, will react to an ad or to a set of circumstances much quicker than he will have evolved the reasons for buying the new car. The reasons come much later, after he has already assumed that he is going to do this. Now, this field, this is a wide field. One of the most interesting aspects of this field, of course, is the new field of psychiatry. There's a field of psychiatry of the permissive group of psychiatrists whose almost total function is to give you an official sanction for something that you've already decided to do. And so if a chick has decided to run away from her family, leave the kids, run away with the traveling salesman, the brushman, and go to Tahiti, she will look for five or six different psychiatrists and or marriage counselors till at last she finds the one who says, yes, you must fulfill yourself for the good of the children and the good of your husband. And the good of all of you, you must go to Tahiti with the brush salesman. Then she comes back with an official sanction. Which came first? Well, I think the need always will supply the motivation in the first place, just as the ads will do that. Speaking of needs, this is WORAM and FM, New York. Have you ever had the feeling that all of radio is down on its knees before you, with great big watery eyes, begging your forgiveness, and will you please buy on the way out? That kind of thing. Almost every radio station I hear, there's even one radio station now on the air here that comes out with a simple admission that says, this is the radio station that's just for you. This is the station that you don't listen to. We listen to you. All right, hold on. It's all right. I thought you had the thing ready in there. It's okay. But now this runs all the way through our business. Now, one more ad I'd like to read here. You see, there are certain things that we won't admit to, even in the conclaves of official admission. If 25 people are sitting around in a room and they're talking about, let us say, world conditions, there are certain things you don't say. Really, you don't. Certain things you really don't say. Whatever they are, you don't say them. You have your private things you don't say. I have mine. And the reasons we don't say them are manifold. And yet we find through the medium of the advertisement and the dream, of which there are many aspects, and don't think that Americans are the only ones who are working in this. I don't know whether you've ever spent any time listening to Radio Moscow. It's intriguing to listen to Radio Moscow over any period of time. You begin to feel that everything that is done in Moscow, in their official organs of communication, Pravda, Red Star, Radio Moscow, is a single, gigantic, nonstop commercial written by some fantastic cosmic ad agency that's looking for nothing but selling points in everything they do. This is an intriguing thing. I don't know. Of course, there's a great deal of that in our world, too. Are you aware that both Americans and Russians use the word America and Russia, or American and Russian, to designate good? In other words, the word American is synonymous with good to us. That means good. Do you know that the Russians also use the word Russian to denote good? The two words are really not synonymous at all, and yet we use them synonymously. Now, I hope you're understanding what I'm saying. I'm not saying that what is American is not good. I'm merely saying that the word American itself means good to millions of people. Just as in Russia, the word Russian means good. Well, of course, that means then, since this is an exclusive designation of the word, that means that all the other countries must be less than that. Just has to be. And so, if you say American, that means good. If you say Peruvian, that means nothing. The average person certainly doesn't, it doesn't mean good, nor does it mean evil. It just means nothing, which is, by the way, less than good. You don't find this in many other countries, strangely enough, even though you possibly might think you would. Nationalism is not quite the same thing. A Frenchman, for example, does not equate French with good. He is more realistic and more outwardly selfish. If you know anything about the French reactions and actions in Algeria, you know that this is very true. But it is rare. There are just two countries in the world who will carry out activities on behalf of themselves, generally, and always say, yeah, vis-a-vis on bad. That's true. It isn't necessarily true that Russia or America always define bad as Russian. But it is getting to that point. Yes. Because it is all part of that dream world that both countries find themselves quietly slipping into. Now here is an example of a fascinating ad, an intriguing ad, and this is a kind of a dream world. Now, dream worlds, how to define a dream world? Well, let us say a dream world is a world in which the exigencies of reality do not exist. In short, it is a world where if you wish to ignore, let's say, gravity, you can. If you wish to ignore the aging process, you can also. That's a dream world. If you look in the beer commercials again, let's take the beer commercials, let's take the automobile commercials, which are even a better example of that. You notice that the automobile commercials hold out somehow the secret promise of a trouble-free youth, which will stretch out before you if you buy the new Starfire 8 or the new Thunderbird or the new Dynaflow this or the new Wide Track that. They rarely talk about technical prowess. They rarely talk about design. They talk about your psyche. Now, the way your psyche is talked about is not in specific terms, but in illustration. So, a beautiful girl is shown getting into the Thunderbird. But you notice that the man who was sitting in the seat is a gentleman who is, I would say, roughly pushing 60. He's got beautiful silvery hair. He's got a bronzed face. And the girl is just out of her second semester at Hunter College. Now the suggestion is always there. And conversely, of course, have you noticed more and more there are certain ads in the automobile world that are only showing women with women? In fact, there's one ad for a car recently that shows two women fleeing down a highway. Two of them, two of the Vogue model type, sharp with their hair flowing in the wind, and these two women are going on and on and on in their new Super Torque Dyna Whoopee 7, and they're whistling into the distance, thereby filling a very interesting void in the heart and the mind of millions of females who would like to also escape too, who would like to escape both from men and from children and from dishwashing and from all of it. You know, the whole business, jump in a car and go, I want to go. So the ad tacitly says, if you buy our car, you can do this. They never imply, it never is a car ever shown dirty. Never. The car in the dream world does not get dirty. I'll never forget one time. If you have any specific relationships with the ad world, you learn some facts about it that would probably surprise you. I'll never forget one time talking to a friend of mine who was a top account executive and who wrote copy and supervised copywriting on one of the big automotive accounts in America, one of the famous cars, which shall go unmentioned here. Well, we were talking about the car, and we were having lunch, and I said, you know, why is it that you never mention the braking system? I happen to be interested in cars personally, technically myself. And at this point, I was even involved in selling them. I had an agency. So I was talking to him, and I said, why don't you mention the fact in your ads, why don't you make a big ad campaign that you have the most advanced braking system in the world? Yeah, they really did in this car. The most technically advanced braking system in the world, that is in production cars, in America, was in this car. And he looked at me as if I had said something awful in church. And I said, what's the trouble? He says, you never talk about brakes to people. He said, because that makes them think of accidents. And if they think of accidents, they don't buy. I says, but what do you talk about? Oh, he says, well, we've got a wonderful thing here where we show this young couple driving the car down the beach, and the waves are coming in, and the wind is blowing, and the gulls are crying, and it talks about how the young people are going for our car. And I said, well, you know, well, I can't argue with him because he's true. Because we all live in this dream world, so I'm not putting the ad world down. We all live in this dream world. It's an interesting thing to stand on the floor of an automobile showroom and talk to people who are otherwise, you know, they're putting down the ad world, and they're hard-hitting history majors, and they people who read The Reporter, and they put down Time magazine, and they dig Mort Saul, and they read Jules Feiffer. You'd be surprised when they get on the floor and they're really going to act. They act exactly the same way all the other people do in the dream world, in exactly the precise way. Now, their dreams take slightly different form. But nevertheless, you will find that the action in the end is exactly the same. Now here's a great ad. This one here. Because not only is there an underlying sexual motif in most ads, but the sexual motif is a far subtler one than just a picture of a girl who looks out at you and says, if you buy this perfume, you'll be sexually attractive and be interesting. One of the new kinds of ads is self-love. Now, the self-love ad, if you'll notice on television, there are four or five type of commercials where a girl, this is particularly a girl's world, where a girl is literally making love to herself. She is pouring whatever the goose grease is in the case over her, and she's rubbing it on her, and there's a voice that says, you have never been so beautiful, Madge. Oh, my God, you're such a fantastic creature. Oh, and she's completely self-involved, and it is not related to eliciting a reaction from men around her or from anyone else. It's the more she can make herself so that she loves herself even more than she did before, if possible, then a greater love itself has been achieved. This has been the subject of several plays recently, but it is much more explicitly stated in the ad world. It is stated. Now, do the ad people, when they write this, do they react? Of course. Because self-love is a big motivating factor in much of American life today. Either love of a country, which in a sense becomes self-love, or literally self-love, me. I remember one day I was listening to an interview, and a man was talking. He was a peace crusader type, and he was talking about why he's for peace. It boiled down to that if there was a war, he would liable to get shot. And he says, I want to live. I just don't want myself. That is not enough reason. That's just not a good reason for peace. Even though it seems to be a good reason, it is the most selfish of reasons. And this is part of the self-love theme which runs through so much of the advertisements in American life today. Here's a great example of self-love and also admitting things which we would not admit under any other circumstances out loud. 1, 2, 3. All together now, get up there, pull in your guts. 1, 2, 3, 4, over. 1, 2, 3, 4. And now we're going into the bicycle crawl now, down on your back. Raise your knees high now. This ad is headlined in bold, straight, hard-hitting black type. Standing straight, not crawling. Does the world think Americans are afraid of nuclear war and death? The true Americans are not. But they are worried about weakness. It seems to them there is too much talk of disarmament and not enough talk of tough preparedness. Too much desire to make deals and not enough insistence on the other side doing the petitioning. too much whispering of words we can't hear. Too much appeasement.
Not enough demand!
Too much
no win. Not enough victory!
Too much trust of the untrustworthy. This is the only nation that has always given, not taken. It seems to us this allows us certain important rights, and we earnestly believe the American people are willing to risk their lives, if need be, to enforce those rights of decency and honor and freedom. Whenever our government has courageously stood up for our nation's right in the world, there's been a heartening wave of enthusiastic support and pride. Americans are not afraid. Theirs is a quiet courage. It is the cowards who do the screaming. Listen for the Americans! Well, now, there is an ad that makes most stuff that comes right out of Pravda read like it's a peace unguent. Of course, all the words sound good, except that you will find, if you look very carefully, again, this is the dream world. The dream world where all you've got to do, and don't think that the dream world doesn't have a lot to do with our international attitudes. There is a large number of people who are living in as much of a dream world in connection with that as the larger group, of course, who believe that by buying the next Helena Rubinstein cream, they really will lose 10 years off their age. They really will be happier when they see the new Rock Hudson picture. They really will live truer, fuller, deeper, richer lives if Elizabeth Taylor marries Dick Burton. That, of course, is another kind of dream world, and it's the same kind of thing. It's the sort of thing where the things that you don't like can just be willed away. That, again, is the definition of the dream world, where no recognition is taken of reality.
Just stand up!
That's the end of it.
Just make the other guy come to you.
The end of it.
Be tough!
That's the end of it.
Cut taxes!
That's the end of it, but be tough at the same time, of course. You know, it's an interesting kind of dream world, and you'll find these things running through the ads. Now, it doesn't make any difference whose advertisement this is. It's important to note, however, it is a company that makes a great deal of money making war equipment. So that's just on the other side. Now we have another kind of ad, which is where almost everything, again, this is part of the dream world, where everything is very, very implied. This one happened to have been in one of the New York Times magazine, a full-page ad. And the ad shows a lady who is past middle age, and she's wearing a nightgown. It's a very, very sheer nightgown. It's a night shift. Shift? Yes, shift. It's a night shift. It's in geranium tricot. Means it's red. Now, she's wearing a red nightgown that is highly transparent and is the kind of nightgown that is quite often seen in houses of lesser repute up and down various streets throughout the world. Now, oh yes, even to the color, you see, and the cut certainly is there. Well, Granny is looking out from this nightgown, and she's wearing her rimless glasses, and she's looking at you, you see. Now, Granny is well up in age there. You can see she's well along in years, and her store choppers are bared. And now, we see Granny now looking right at us, and she's looking at us devilishly. Granny, I would say, is roughly 60 to 65. This is Mama, or Grandmama, really, is what it is. And Granny is looking out at us from her night shift in geranium tricot, highly transparent, and all Granny is saying to us is this: I did it, and I'm glad.
Bye.
Now, there you have the dream world in full operation. Now that's probably a highly extreme example, but nevertheless, there it is, a full-page ad in the Times. Now, Granny, the question is, will Granny get a chance to do it? Well, now, that is never asked. But the implied thing there is that if Granny buys the night shift in Geranium Trico for $19.95, Granny will not only get the chance, but I'm glad I did it. It's harmless fun. And, sure it is. Except the trouble is that the harmlessness ceases after Granny has bought 17 separate Geranium Trico night shifts and nothing has happened and she finally shoots her husband between the eyes, which unfortunately is where it generally works out. Either that or she kills the Iceman. Now, because somewhere along the line, the dream has to run head smack into the glacier. And that's when the trouble always begins. One of the beautiful parts of the dream, just as we watch the people all running around on that Ballantine Beach, I must say some of my favorite commercials, if you're interested in favorite commercials, are the Rheingold Extra Dry Extra Talented Players. I must admit that I like that crew. They do more stuff in 58 seconds. They sing more songs, throw more pies, holler more than any off-Broadway crowd I've seen in years. They really move. I think those are great commercials, and they're very harmless because they do not enter the dream world. They merely entertain you. Now, I'll give you the other side. They often turn out good commercials. Now, this here is a more subtle kind of commercial. Subtle in its implication and more obvious in the way it's done. Now, one thing that most adults in our world do, we don't get much of a chance to deal with the world of the child. What is really operative in the child world? Some of the saddest junk, I almost used another word which was much more applicable, some of the saddest, rottenest stuff I've ever seen in my life is the new current wave of books for children done by serious writers. Awful stuff, just awful stuff. And why people get the idea that children like pictures drawn in the style the way children would draw them is they just don't understand kids. The only reason kids draw that way, people, is that they don't know how to draw. No, really, and kids are aware of it. They're very mad that they can't draw good. Do you remember when you were a kid? And so when a kid sees another drawing done by another kid or by a grown-up trying to draw like a kid, he just recognizes it as rotten drawing. This is true. For that reason, you will find very few comic books which kids really react to, much more than they react to the shishi books that you buy at FAO Schwartz. They will react far more to the comic because they're drawn with the explicitness that the kid is trying for but not quite making. Kids have a very realistic mind. They are not Shirley Jackson. Kids are not Carson McCullers, you know, even though she likes to dream of little big-eyed girls in sad cafes. I'm not sure that kids see it that way. And in fact, most kids are thoroughly bored by the children's books that are coming off by the thousands from the very well-meaning presses who believe, one, that kids talk like this. That is the book. The book is read. Forget it. No, kids are bored by that kind of thing even more than the parents who have to read it. And yet it is done over and over again. You know, the kind of book that advertises itself as 153 words, the basic vocabulary of the three-year-old, that the 153 words, terrible stuff. Well, where it really works, however, the communication with children, is in the comic books themselves. Now, most parents are trying like mad to keep the kids away from comic books, and they're continually shoving in their hands these $4 specials. Arthur Miller writes a comic book, a kid book. Oi, did you read it? Oh, whew, what a terrible kid book. They completely miss the point of children, which is that children want to be treated not as children, but as someone to whom a story is being told. Kids do not like to be reminded eternally that they're kids. This is a very, very, very tough thing with kids. Now, children, I am going to tell you a story that has a very deep moral to it. Once upon a time, in a little town named Westport, there was a little boy who used to sit and look out of the window on days when he was sick. One day, another little boy came past the house, and he was carrying with him a red balloon. The first little boy said, "I want your red balloon." The second little boy said, "Here, take my red balloon." And then the first little boy ran out and took the red balloon. Oh, yeah, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. Or else, this is the fire chief. The way the fire chief works is this. He lives in the firehouse. He is the chief of all the firemen. Oh, boy. And, of course, those same well-meaning idiots are doing away with the Oz stories. They're doing away with Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. They're even doing away in some places with Huck Finn. They're doing away with Mark Twain. They're doing away with anything that smacks of literature and replacing it with this pseudo-literature. This is all, again, part of the dream world. Getting back to the kind of ads now, are you aware this is the kind of ad that is appearing in kid books and is making, and is making a real impact on the kids, much more so than the novels, the little things with the tricky little drawings and the three-color overlays. One, two, three, four.
America's most exciting war game. Nuclear naval battle game. An action-packed thrill-a-minute game. Every commander maneuvers every ship with authentic tactics and controls, sonar, mine-laying, torpedo runs, plane launchings, and ship-to-shore combat. A convoy of terror! A complete game, 132-piece navies, giant battle area, two gyro indicators, simple directions, a comparison chart of the two most powerful navies in the world, United States and guess who? Yes, it's Task Force, America's most exciting war game. Two giant battlefields, a total size of 3 square feet, 6 islands in the Pacific Ocean, beautifully colored, 88-piece task force in gray and green, 4 aircraft carriers, 24 planes, 8 landing barges, 4 headquarters, 4 battleships, 4 destroyers, 4 carriers, 16 tanks with movable turrets, 24 pillboxes. These unbreakable 3D metallic plastic toys are authentically scaled at each as realistic proportion to give you all the thrill, all the excitement, and all the fun of a real battlefield. Yes, tension runs high as a big full-scale battle looms and crashes with all the elements participating on land, sea, and air. The team best able to strategically place his forces and direct his firing will be the only battle survivor. There is no imagination necessary here, boys and girls. You get the equipment, the battlefield, and the rules on how to locate, occupy, and destroy the enemy. It is actually played and tremendously enjoyed by important members of our real armed forces. Money back guaranteed if you are not absolutely delighted. Send your name and address to Helen of Toy Company.
Okay. Now, the thing that's intriguing about this is also, of course, part of another dream world. Just as almost all ads that we have, they hold out the promise, of course, of mastery over your enemies. Whether your enemies be sexual, whether your enemies be political, or whether your enemies be economic, the power is always there. It's all part of the kind of self-perpetuating dream that most of us live in. Now, have you ever wondered? Because it wasn't always this way. Now, I'm not talking about a downfall of morality or a decay of attitude. It is a change in attitude. That just about 50 to 60 years ago, in fact, within comparatively recent memory, when people went to stores, they went to stores to fill an actual need in their world. For example, it would be a common thing for someone to say, well, I'm going to take Charlie downtown to buy him a pair of shoes. That's what would be called shopping. Or we are going downtown to see whether we can buy a tire for the Oldsmobile. Or we are going downtown to see if we can get a throw rug for the front hall. That's called buying whatever it is that you need. In short, there was a specific need that was required and was filled by something that was purchased. However, have you noticed today that shopping itself is an end in itself? That millions of people will be in Macy's or Gimbel's or Alexander's, and they will be just shopping with a kind of fervor that was never known when somebody was just out to buy a skid chain, or he went in to buy a new brush, or they went in to buy a vacuum cleaner. It is a very different thing, because what the people are pursuing is not the object any longer. They are pursuing, in a sense, the dream resultant of that object. A man is pursuing youth. A woman is pursuing love. Granny is not buying. Give me the little thing. Get ready in there? Hold it there. Granny is not buying a geranium trico shift. Granny is buying the right to say, I did it and I'm glad. And she will pursue it with the same fervor, of course, that the golden apples and the... speaking of golden apples, Eddie.
This is Radio Gren Fenwick taking you live to Carnegie Hall. Come in, Carnegie Hall.
This is Carnegie Hall speaking. Today we will hear the premier performance of the Grand Fenwick Philharmonic Orchestra playing the Mouse on the Moon cantata. The conductor is now raising his baton. We are ready to begin. The musical selection you are listening to was composed by the Grand Duchess Gloriana XIII to commemorate her country's colossal achievement of being the first to land on the moon. This claim is substantiated in the motion picture, The Mouse on the Moon. You'll roar at the further adventures of the mouse that roared. See The Mouse on the Moon.
Hello, Cinema One. Cinema One. Speaking of dreams, get more out of real life. Enjoy life more. Live it deeper, richer, more fully. Go to a movie this week. Yes, go to a movie this week. Especially see if you can go to one with a real widescreen picture in full 17-color Technodynamotion. Why don't you try one of the new Erotoscope movies where you can really feel the emotion, really understand how Elizabeth Taylor felt for Richard Burton. Move, Dad, move.